On this Monday, July 20th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. Scientists at Oxford University and at the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca say they are developing what could be a safe and strong immune response to coronavirus. The vaccine trial has involved nearly 1,000 individuals, producing both antibodies and T cells, which can find and attack the virus. It is just one of a number of research labs racing to find a treatment for COVID-19. This comes as new polling numbers from NBC News and The Wall Street Journal showing that only 37% of registered voters approve of the president's handling of this pandemic. President Trump indicating that he will likely bring back his regular task force briefings, possibly as early as tomorrow. And Democratic leaders on Capitol Hill asking the FBI for an urgent briefing, arising out of concern that members of Congress are being targeted by a foreign operation intended to influence the 2020 election. It comes as lawmakers of both parties have warned in the past that foreign powers like Russia are intent on interfering in the election process. The story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with the very latest on coronavirus. According to Johns Hopkins University, which has been keeping track of the numbers from the very beginning, 31 states have seen new cases this past week compared to new cases from the previous week, many setting records. In Florida, at least 50 hospitals are out of ICU space. That according to Florida's Agency for Healthcare Administration. And in particular, Miami-Dade County hit hard, where the ICU capacity is now at 130% of occupancy. Out in Los Angeles, LA County reporting its highest number of COVID-19 hospitalizations in a single day, with at least 2,200 people now hospitalized, and more than half of the nearly 3,000 cases reported over the weekend were those under the age of 40. Arizona reporting its highest number of COVID-19 cases in a single day. Also, Georgia and North Carolina both having record high numbers. And in Arizona, also a record number of deaths on Sunday. In Texas, Dallas County and San Antonio have brought in refrigerated trucks because they're running out of space to hold the bodies of those who have passed away from COVID-19. Now, since the outset, more than 3.7 million Americans have been infected with the virus. The U.S. death toll has now surpassed 140,000. At the White House earlier today, the president once again putting the blame on China.
We're going to give you a lot of briefings in the next week and over the next few weeks as to, I think it's very important to do it, the vaccines and the therapeutics. I think I'm going to bring some of the great companies that are working and very successfully in the past have worked on these things, and they're going to tell you very specifically what they're doing and how they're doing. But we think we're doing very well in that regard. Those two items, I think, frankly, therapeutic, I like almost better at this point. You go in and you make people better. Now, we have had some very good luck with remdesivir. That's been successful. And others have been successful. The plasma has been successful. But we are really coming up with some very good answers, meaning they are. All over the world, they're working, and we're working very closely all over the world on the vaccines and the therapeutics. So we're going to have some of the heads of these great companies coming in. Johnson & Johnson is doing very well in particular. They seem to be doing very well, but numerous are doing very well. It's something that I really feel certain. I guess you can never use totally certain, but pretty damn certain that they're going to have the vaccine, they're going to have therapeutics, and it's going to start taking place very shortly. And that will be a great thing for the world. That will be a great thing. But this is happening all over the world, not just the United States. And it's a tough one. It's very tough. It's very sad when you see the death. It's all death that could have been stopped by China. If they wanted to stop it, they could have stopped it.
That with the president earlier today in the Oval Office, and this question from Reuters White House correspondent Steve Holland.
Are they bringing back the coronavirus briefings? Is that, do I understand you correctly?
Well, we had very successful briefings. I was doing them, and we had a lot of people watching, record numbers watching. In the history of cable television, there's never been anything like it. And we were doing very well. And I thought it would be sort of automatic, and a lot of positive things were happening. And frankly, a lot of the country is doing well. A lot of people don't say, as you understand. But we have had this big flare-up in Florida, Texas, a couple of other places. So I think what we're going to do is I'll get involved and we'll start doing briefings, whether it's this afternoon or tomorrow, probably tomorrow, and I'll do briefings. And part of the briefing, I think, much more so than last time, because last time we were nowhere with vaccines or therapeutics. And let's say that ended 6 weeks ago, we'll start them again. And I think it's a great way to get information out to the public as to where we are with the vaccines, with the therapeutics, and generally speaking, where we are. And so I think we'll start that probably starting tomorrow. I'll do it at 5 o'clock like we were doing. We had a good slot. And a lot of people were watching, and that's a good thing. I think that Kaylee will continue hers at 11 o'clock, just like they were. And I'll be discussing the, as I call it, the China virus, the China plague. I'll be discussing it. And I'll also be discussing perhaps some other things. But, you know, we're doing very well in so many different ways. But unfortunately, this is something that's very tough, but we're going to get it solved. And I think we're going to get it solved in numerous ways, but the two best would be vaccines and therapeutics. So we'll be having that.
From the White House earlier today, in case you're interested, the Wall Street Journal has posted an extensive story looking at the situation in Europe, including Germany, France, Greece, and Italy. The headline, how Europe kept coronavirus cases low even after reopening. It reads in part as follows, quote, when Western European countries began phasing out their lockdowns this spring, a surge of coronavirus cases was widely expected to follow. Months on, even as Europeans mingle in bars and restaurants and crowded beaches, that still has not happened. As a surge in cases forces a number of U.S. states to reimpose restrictions, Europe's reopening is, for the most part, going according to plan. That is largely because of marked changes in social behavior across much of Europe, following widespread efforts by policymakers to drill the public the following messages: a three-pronged approach, keep a distance when possible, enhance hygiene, and wear a mask when necessary. Older people who are also more vulnerable are especially careful. The full story at WSJ.com. And now to Capitol Hill, where lawmakers are back in Washington today for a sprint before the August recess. The fight, of course, over the next round of coronavirus aid coming to a head as Congress facing multiple hurdles to reach an agreement. This is likely going to be the last major piece of legislation before the November election. It remains clear, however, that Democrats and Republicans have some major differences. We'll get some background on that in just a moment. Leading the negotiations for the Trump administration is Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. He was with the president earlier today at the White House.
Mark and I have been working very hard over the last 2 weeks with Mitch and Kevin on really what we see as the focus is kids and jobs. The Recovery Act, CARES 4.0. We've spent an unprecedented amount of money. The good news is a lot of the $3 trillion we still have left to put in the economy and put back to work. We're focused on starting with another $1 trillion. We think that will make a big impact. And the focus is, as I said, is really about kids and jobs and vaccines. We're going to make sure that we have a vaccine by the end of the year for emergency use. And the plan is we just updated the president and the vice president. They signed off on this. Mark and I will be meeting tomorrow with the Republicans at the lunch to give them a full briefing. And then we will also be reaching out to the Democrats to begin our discussions. But we are committed that by the end of this month, make sure that before the enhanced unemployment insurance expires, that we pass legislation so that we can protect Americans that are unemployed. Now, we've said the number one issue is we have to fix the technical fix on enhanced unemployment. We're going to make sure that we don't pay people more money to stay home than go to work. We want to make sure that people who can go to work safely can do so. We'll have tax credits that incentivize businesses to bring people back to work. We'll have tax credits for PPE, for safe work environment. And we're going to have big incentives, money to the states for education, for schools that can open safely and do education. So these are the priorities, as well as liability protection. We want to make sure that frivolous lawsuits don't prevent schools, universities, and businesses from reopening.
That from the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. He was joined by the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy and made reference to former Congressman, now White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. The White House is pushing for a payroll tax cut, but at the moment, something, according to TheHill.com, Republican lawmakers are not advocating. Congressional Republicans are looking, as you heard, at the price tag of between $1 trillion to $1.3 trillion. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell will be unveiling the details of the GOP plan later this week. He also was at the White House.
Yeah, tomorrow begins the process of socializing what we've been discussing with the administration over the last 2 weeks with our members. And if you're looking for a theme here, think liability protection for those who've been trying to deal with the pandemic. We don't need an epidemic of lawsuits on the heels of the pandemic we're already struggling with. Kids in school, jobs, and health care would be the theme of the proposal that we hope to come together and present to our Republicans. And then, as the Secretary of the Treasury indicated, obviously you can't pass the bill in the Senate without the Democrats, and we'll begin to talk to them as well.
That from Senator McConnell, Republican of Kentucky. On MSNBC earlier today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi pointing out that House Democrats already passed what it calls the CARES Act, a bill, though, that was dead on arrival in the Republican-controlled Senate. Speaker Pelosi was asked about that and about the president's interview yesterday, which continues to get a lot of attention with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday, one of the five Sunday programs we re-air here on C-SPAN Radio. In that interview, the president did not indicate whether he would be accepting the results of the November election.
The fact is, whether he knows it yet or not, he will be leaving. Just because he might not want to move out of the White House doesn't mean we won't have an inauguration ceremony to inaugurate a duly elected president of the United States. And the I'm second in line to the presidency, and just last week I had my regular continuation of government briefing. This might interest you because I say to them, this is never going to happen. God willing, it never will. But there is a process. It has nothing to do with that the certain occupant of the White House doesn't feel like moving and has to be fumigated out of there, because the presidency is the presidency. It's not geography or location. So much for him. I wouldn't spend so much time on it. That's a victory for him, because then we're not talking about your first more important subject, which is what are we going to do to stop this vicious virus that is making an assault on our health, our lives, our livelihood, life of our democracy. In the HEROES Act, we have $3.6 billion for vote by mail. This is very, very important. It's what is needed in our country, and it has bipartisan support throughout the country. Mm-hmm. Secretaries of State and other auspices for under which elections take place are calling for the resources. They don't want any barriers to it. We have some additions we'd like, which is every registered voter gets to vote by mail with return postage paid, that those who don't want to can go and vote, but in a safe way, with a lot of time leading up and a lot of locations so that people are not crowded into it. This is simple. When I say simple, we know what we need to do. Again, ignore what the president has to say. He doesn't know what he's talking about once again.
From MSNBC earlier today, Morning Joe and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The Senate today is also back in session. Here is Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
We must consider another major COVID relief package this work period. Enhanced unemployment benefits expire at the end of the month. Protections against evictions expire this week. And schools are preparing for the fall without the necessary guidance and resources to open safely. The country is crying out for relief. The needless delays, the partisan politics, the infighting between the president and Senate and House Republicans has got to stop. But it seems that Leader McConnell has still not received that message. The Republican leader has said he's writing the next bill behind the closed doors of his office, and he will present it to his party first before dropping it on the Senate's lap. This one-party approach is the same approach that delayed the passage of the CARES Act, delayed the passage of the subsequent emergency relief legislation, utterly failed on policing reform, where the Republican bill was opposed by 136 civil rights organizations. For Leader McConnell to then get up and talk about that bill when the people were marching for a much stronger bill, the Justice and Policing Act, when civil rights organizations were urging that we not move forward on that bill, is twisting history in a way that no one is going to believe and history will never accept. Each time Congress passed COVID relief, all four times, we did it by coming together in a bipartisan fashion between our two parties, between our two chambers. Leader McConnell three times tried to force a partisan bill down the Senate's throat, and it backfired every time. Leader McConnell, it won't work this time either. Leader McConnell called for my bipartisanship this morning. That's great. But Leader McConnell, sitting in your own office, writing a bill and demanding the other side support it is not anyone's idea of bipartisanship. And even worse, it appears that the Republican proposal is unlikely to meet the moment. From what we understand from press reports, McConnell's bill will prioritize corporate special interests over workers in Main Street businesses. It will fail to inadequately address the worsening spread of the virus. There are currently between 20 and 30 million unemployed Americans, and from all accounts, the Republican bill will not do nearly enough for them.
That from the Senate floor earlier today with Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. And Sean Zeller of CQ Roll Call writes the following, quote, "It will take compromise for lawmakers to coalesce around another coronavirus relief bill." The editor of CQ Magazine and the host of CQ on Congress podcast is joining us on the phone. My opening question, how did they get there?
Well, both parties have very different priorities going into this, Steve. But I don't think their differences are insurmountable if each is willing to give a little bit.
Are there any red lines for Democrats and Republicans?
Definitely there are. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader from Kentucky, has made it abundantly clear that he sees liability protections as a red line for Republicans. And by liability protections, he means protections from lawsuits for businesses, but also schools and also healthcare providers who are serving customers and patients and their own workforce who may contract the virus in the course of reopening or doing their jobs. And so he very much wants to see them protected, provided they take some steps, which they have not spelled out, to protect people from contracting the virus. Democrats, by contrast, I see their wants as bigger. They want a lot of money for the states, which have been hurt very badly by declining revenue, particularly sales tax revenue. And they also want more relief for Americans who've lost their jobs, Americans who are at threat of losing their apartments or their homes, and they want to be as generous as possible in helping them.
That relief has included the $600 per week additional unemployment benefits that really have been in place since the start of this pandemic. The expiration is July 31st. Will Republicans go along with any sort of extension?
It looks like they will. From what we heard today, after Mitch McConnell and the Republican leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, met with President Trump and the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, is that they will look to extend unemployment benefits, but probably not at that $600 per week level. That $600 level is very generous. For a lot of workers, they're making more on the unemployment rolls than they were previously in their jobs. And that was partially because of the difficulty of very quickly helping so many people who'd lost their jobs in March and April and just getting the money out the door. But also because at that time the thinking was, we really don't want these people going back to work. We want people staying at home, and this is kind of a bridge. But we're in a different place now. States are starting to reopen. The Republicans feel that we have to come to some sort of balance between protecting against the virus and reopening the economy. And so they are concerned that $600 is preventing people from going back to work, that it's too generous. And so what seems likely is you'll get an extension, but maybe $300 or $400 a week instead of the $600.
We're talking with Sean Zeller of CQ Roll Call. How is K Street responding to all of this? That, of course, known as the location where most of the lobbyists in Washington work. Are they involved in these talks?
Absolutely. I mean, for business interests in the Capitol, this is one of the few vehicles, one of the few bills that is moving. And so if they have a need, this is the place that they're targeting to get that provision appended, whether it's some sort of tax break or virus-related relief. And certainly a lot of them can make a very good case that they need it. The government has, of course, already been doing a lot to help companies. The Federal Reserve has been making loans, which is one reason the stock market has held up as well as it has. And, of course, the Paycheck Protection Program, those forgivable loans, grants, essentially, that the government is giving to companies with 500 or fewer employees. There's some talk of making that even more flexible and extending it in this next round of virus relief.
And by all accounts, it looks as if the House and Senate will be in session for the next 3 weeks. We then move into the party convention season. So in terms of the timeline and the calendar, what are you looking at?
Well, I think it would be ideal if they could finish it up by the end of the month, July 31st, when these important provisions such as the $600 a week unemployment benefit, the moratorium on evictions from federally subsidized housing, those things are set to expire at the end of the month. But certainly they could go into early August and make those provisions retroactive. It probably wouldn't do much damage if they did, and I expect they may, given the amount of negotiating that has to happen and the amount of time left in that calendar.
The story available at rollcall.com. Sean Zeller, he's also editor of CQ Magazine and the host of CQ on Congress podcast. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, Steve. It was a pleasure.
And welcome back. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your other headlines. We're still about a month away from the Democratic convention. Details, though, are beginning to emerge. Former Republican governor and 2016 GOP presidential candidate John Kasich is expected to speak at the Democratic convention to support Joe Biden. The Cleveland Plain Dealer is reporting that John Kasich is one of a number of high-profile Republicans who intend to work against Trump's re-election in the closing days of the campaign. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Ted Cruz warning the Texas GOP state convention that if the Democrats win the Lone Star State, both the White House and the Senate are gone. In a video to attendees at a virtual convention over the weekend, the Republican senator saying that Texas is the single biggest target for the left in 2020. There are 38 electoral votes at stake. There's a U.S. Senate seat at stake. And Texas, he said, is the key to national domination for years to come. By the way, we'll have live coverage of both national conventions as Democrats gather in Milwaukee for their virtual convention, Republicans in Jacksonville, Florida. It's all next month, live on the C-SPAN networks. As the House and Senate returned today, there was bipartisan praise for the son of sharecroppers who survived a brutal beating during the landmark march in Selma, Alabama, back in 1965. He became a civil rights leader and a respected public official. John Lewis has been described as the conscience of Congress, serving in that chamber for more than 30 years, and the tributes continue to pour in. Here is how the House opened its session today with Chaplain Patrick Conroy.
Let us pray. Loving God, Father of us all, Father of all our ancestors, thank you for giving us another day. The Congress returns, mourning the loss of a sweet man, a saint, warrior, and prophet, John Lewis. A saint in his commitment to nonviolence in a violent world, where all too often people are oppressed for their nationality, their tribe, their religion, their color. A warrior in his lifelong commitment to engaging in good trouble, to break down the forces of separation, especially in this nation of ours, to challenge those who would claim innocence in their actions designed to maintain a caste society based on race, and address the systems of exclusion, from full participation in the freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution, especially participation in the vote. A prophet who spoke of your will, that we become the beloved community here on earth. A beloved community he has now joined among the community of saints, the cloud of witnesses to your love and your truth. In all this, John's work must now be our own. Bless the members of this chamber with the courage and wisdom to address the ongoing challenges that John Lewis encountered his entire life. Help them, help us all, to bring forth the beloved community in our midst, where all men and women might live together in the land of the free and the home of the brave. May all that is done in the People's House this day and in all the days to come be for your greater honor and glory. Amen.
This morning, the House Chaplain, Patrick Conroy. The death of Congressman Lewis has renewed interest in the campaign to rename the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, which of course was the site of a turning point in the civil rights fight. Named after a former Confederate general and a Ku Klux Klan leader, the bridge of course became the focus of national attention on March 7, 1965, known as Bloody Sunday. At the time, John Lewis was the chair of what was called SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He helped lead the march. He sustained a cracked skull. It was, though, a turning point in the civil rights movement here in the U.S. Again, the tributes pouring in for the former congressman who passed away on Friday. John Lewis represented the Atlanta area. From the House floor, Democratic leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland.
I have walked with John Lewis at least 15 times across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where with courage and commitment, he made a seminal difference in the life of our country. Many of us walked with him as we followed in John Lewis's footsteps. I suspect my colleagues saw, as I did, that the man we knew to be a veteran legislator and a person of wisdom and experience still carried in his heart the same energy, optimism, and determined spirit that he bore in his youth. John never stopped being the young man who dreamed of change and knew it could be achieved. In that springtime Alabama sun, he beamed with a passion for justice and shone that light back on all of us who marched with him. Even at 80, John Robert Lewis had the heart and fiery soul of a young protester for a righteous cause, an organizer for the community and the country he served. Every day of his life, John marched for justice, civil rights, peace, and equality. On every step on his journey, he brought all of us and this country he loved with him. On Friday, John's march on earth came to an end, and he was revered as a good and faithful servant. Now, Mr. Speaker, he rests in the bosom of God.
That from the House Democratic leader, Steny Hoyer of Maryland. Congressman Lewis announced earlier this year that he was suffering from pancreatic cancer, and as you heard just a moment ago, he lost his six-month battle late Friday evening when word came of his death. Texas Congressman Al Green, a longtime friend of Congressman Lewis.
Well, when it came to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, not only did he rise to the occasion by marching across that bridge, he made the occasion by helping to organize the march that left Brown Chapel and went to that bridge. Knowing that they were facing the constabulary with clubs, they marched on. Knowing that they were marching into brutality, they marched on. He was a person who understood that the cause of justice will sometimes require some harm to be suffered. Yet he marched on. And for this reason, the world had an opportunity to see the horrors of invidious discrimination. And in so seeing, a president, Lyndon Johnson, was put in a position such that he could pass the Voting Rights Act. And after the passage of that act, many of us who are in Congress today are here because he marched across that bridge. So I would say to you, Mr. Speaker, I would say to you, because of his courage, because he walked the talk, because he was there for us at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and because the Voting Rights Act was passed as a result thereof, it seems to me that it would be proper, appropriate, and befitting of this body and all of Congress to now pass the reformation of the Voting Rights Act so that we can show the world that voting is still important to all people in this country.
That from Texas Congressman Al Green from the House floor earlier today as Congress pays tribute to their friend and colleague John Lewis. The Georgia congressman was 80 years old. Also on the to-do list for Congress, both the House and Senate are debating their separate drafts of the annual defense authorization bill this week, including potentially controversial amendments on base names, border wall funding, and a host of other issues. Washington Democratic Congressman Adam Smith is the chair of the House Armed Services Committee. His remarks earlier today on the House floor.
I want at this point thank the ranking member of the committee, Mr. Thornberry, for his incredible leadership during this process. He's been a terrific partner both when he was chairman of the committee and now that he is the ranking member of the committee. As all of you know, this will be his last NDAA as he's retiring from Congress, and I just want to once again thank him for his great work and his great leadership and really emphasize a point that I have made many, many times. The Armed Services Committee works in a bipartisan way and produces a legislative product in a manner that I think should be an example for all of Congress. That does not happen by accident. It happens because of leadership. And when Mr. Thornberry became chairman of the committee and I was ranking member, Mac showed that leadership from the very start. He understood the priority of getting the bill done and of working in a bipartisan way to do that. And because of that leadership, that example has been set for the committee, and we've been able to continue to accomplish that. I also want to thank the Rules Committee. That is not an easy job in the best of times, and as we all know, these are not the best of times. 752 amendments were submitted to be added to this bill this year. The Rules Committee had to sift through and process all of those amendments to produce before you the rule that we all just approved today. I thank their staff for doing that incredible work and do want to pause just one moment in this to thank the staff for the work they did in light of COVID-19. We all know that things cannot be run the way they normally are. We had to make adjustments. The staff in particular had to make those adjustments, just getting our committee hearing room set up so that we could accommodate a socially distancing markup took an enormous amount of time and technological know-how. Staff did a fabulous job to get us to this point. Guess what I'm saying is it's no accident that we're here. A lot of work went to get us to the moment to have what I think is an excellent product. And again, we can't forget the central premise behind this product, and that is to support our national security policy and to make sure that the men and women who serve in our military, who we assign with the task of implementing that policy, have the tools and training and equipment that they need to perform whatever tasks we ask them to do.
That from Congressman Adam Smith. He made reference to Mac Thornberry, who is retiring this year, by the way. He is the ranking Republican on the House Armed Services Committee. This is what he told lawmakers.
On the bill before us, I am very grateful for the kind words of Chairman Smith, as well as for the generous amendment he offered in committee related to the name of this bill, and also the very generous response of all members on both sides of the aisle. I'll confess, Mr. Speaker, that all of this naming business makes me a little uncomfortable because this bill is not about any of us. It's about the men and women who serve our nation and their families and American national security. And as the chairman points out, that's the focus of this bill for 59 straight years. And with his leadership, the leadership of Senator Reid and Senator Inhofe, I'm sure that it will be number 60. Obviously, I do not agree with everything that's in the bill, but on balance, it's a good bill. And in some particular areas, it's a very good bill. And I just want to highlight, for example, the family resiliency and readiness provisions, thanks to good work from Mr. Kelly and Ms. Speer. I want to highlight a number of cyber and artificial intelligence provisions, thanks to the good work of Mr. Langevin, Ms. Stefanik, Mr. Gallagher, who chaired one of the committees we set up. A number of provisions in this bill strengthen relationships with partners and allies. And among others who have worked on this, Mr. Gallego, Mr. Crow, Ms. Cheney, Mr. Turner, there is a lot of very good substance in this bill. And bringing it all together, I want to credit the leadership of the chairman, not only for assembling a bill of good substance, for passing it by a vote of 56 to nothing, and doing so in a very, very challenging time. And I join him in applauding the staff, not just the substance, but the logistics, all that was required to bring this bill to us.
That from Congressman Thornberry of Texas. The debate will continue in the House and in the Senate on the NDAA, which is the National Defense Authorization Bill. Live coverage, the House on C-SPAN, the Senate on C-SPAN 2. An update on that shooting that took place yesterday. The gunman suspected of killing the son and wounding the husband of a federal judge in New Jersey before taking his own life in New York's Catskills has been identified as a lawyer. His name, Rory Den Hollander. He was found dead in the town of Rockland, New York, earlier today. His website details, quote, anti-feminist cases and calls for clients to, quote, help battle the infringement of men's rights by the feminists. Investigators believe that Attorney Hollander shot himself hours after an attack on the North Brunswick, New Jersey home of federal judge Esther Salas. A gunman dressed in a FedEx uniform came to the home at around 5 p.m. last night and opened fire, killing the 20-year-old son Daniel, who was a student, by the way, at Catholic University here in Washington, D.C. He also critically wounded her husband. Judge Salas was in the home at the basement at the time. She was not physically hurt. The investigation continues into the motive. And more legal problems for Fox News. A lawsuit filed in federal court today accusing Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity of sexual harassment. It also claims other former and current Fox News anchors as defendants, filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. It is a 39-page complaint documenting what it calls a sweeping set of allegations against the network. In one example, the document states that Fox News repeatedly supported and promoted former anchor Ed Henry, despite the fact that the network was well aware of Mr. Henry's inappropriate sexual misconduct. Back in 2016, it was revealed that Henry was having an affair with a Las Vegas cocktail waitress, and now there are allegations that he raped and physically abused Jennifer Eckhart, a former Fox News producer. The lawsuit is also making charges against Tucker Carlson, who hosts the 8 p.m. program, and Sean Hannity, who is on the air at 9 p.m. nightly. On Wall Street, a big day for the Nasdaq, jumping 263 points. The S&P was up 27. Only modest gains for the Dow, up 9. In London today, a further crackdown on China by the British government. The Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab today extending the UK's arms embargo, which has been in place with China since back in 1989. The reason, they want to make sure that the arms do not potentially, these lethal weapons don't end up from Hong Kong to China. Britain has also suspended extraditions to Hong Kong immediately and indefinitely. More details from the House of Commons with the British Foreign Secretary.
Mr. Speaker, the second measure relates to the fact that the imposition of this new national security legislation has significantly changed key assumptions underpinning our extradition treaty arrangements with Hong Kong. And I have to say I'm particularly concerned about Articles 55 to 59 of the law, which give mainland China Chinese authorities the ability to assume jurisdiction over certain cases and to try those cases in mainland Chinese courts. Mr. Speaker, the national security law does not provide legal or judicial safeguards in such cases, and I'm also concerned about the potential reach of the extraterritorial provisions. So I have consulted with the Home Secretary, the Justice Secretary, and the Attorney General, and the government has decided to suspend the extradition treaty immediately and indefinitely. And I should also tell the House that we would not consider reactivating those arrangements unless and until there are clear and robust safeguards which are able to prevent extradition from the UK being misused under the new national security legislation. Mr. Speaker, there remains considerable uncertainty about the way in which the new national security law will be enforced. I would just say this, the United Kingdom is watching and the whole world is watching.
From the House of Commons earlier today, meanwhile, in an interview, Prime Minister Boris Johnson was asked about its policies towards China. As that country continues to crack down on Hong Kong, this is what he told the BBC.
Be very clear, there is a balance here, and I'm not going to be sort of pushed into a position of becoming a knee-jerk Sinophobe on every issue, somebody who is automatically anti-China. But we do have serious concerns. We have concerns about the treatment of the Uyghur minority, obviously, about the human rights abuses. We obviously have concerns about what's happening in Hong Kong, and you'll be hearing a bit later on from the Foreign Secretary about how we're going to change our extradition arrangements to reflect our concerns about what's happening with the security law in Hong Kong. We have to think about the human rights, the rights of the people of Hong Kong to participate in democratic processes, and people here from Hong Kong, and how those changes affect them. What we won't do, as I say, is completely abandon our policy of engagement with China. China is a giant fact of geopolitics. It's going to be a giant factor in our lives, in the lives of our children and our grandchildren. So we've got to have a calibrated response, and we're going to be tough on some things, but also going to continue to engage.
That pronouncement earlier today with the British Prime Minister in an interview available on the BBC website. Back here at home, the top U.S. infectious disease expert and Washington Nationals fan, Dr. Anthony Fauci, he will throw out the ceremonial first pitch on opening day this Thursday. The Nats announcing that the, quote, superfan will do the honors. Dr. Fauci, quote, has been a true champion for our country during the COVID-19 pandemic and throughout his distinguished career, so it is only fitting that we honor him as we kick off the 2020 season and defend our World Series championship title. Yes, the Nats won the World Series last year, that from Nats Park. And finally, it was on this date that millions of Americans stayed up late to watch history. Neil Armstrong becoming the first person to step foot on the moon July 20th, 1969. And from the White House, President Nixon was watching as well.
I just can't tell you how proud we all are of what you have done. For every American, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. And for people all over the world, I am sure that they, too, join with Americans in recognizing what an immense feat this is. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world.
On this date, 51 years ago in 1969, as we stepped foot on the moon, and those remarks by President Richard Nixon. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. You can get it on our website at cspan.org/podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully for this Monday evening. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your night.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day, we're taking your calls live on the air on the news of the day, and we discuss policy issues that impact you. Coming up Tuesday morning, American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten discusses the union's position in the debate over reopening schools amid the coronavirus pandemic. And American Conservative Union Chair Matt Schlapp will be on to talk about Campaign 2020 and President Trump's reelection strategy. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal, live at 7 Eastern, Tuesday morning. And be sure to join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, and text messages and tweets. Join the discussion.